Welcome to the NACE Journal Club podcast, where every month we're going to be bringing you the most important articles to come out in primary care. And this month we've got quite a group of articles, beginning with an article in JAMA on the strategies to increase cervical cancer screening using mailed-in self-swabs of HPV. And this will be discussed by Dr. Amy Klaus. Our next article, which is critically important to all of us, is the association between changes in carbohydrate intake and long-term weight changes, published in BMJ Open Access. And we have an invited guest, Dr. Walter Willett, one of the icons in the field, to discuss this article. And our third article this month is an overview of the new and updated American Academy of Dermatology guidelines for the care of management of atopic dermatitis in adults using topical therapies. For our first article this month, we have a fascinating article from JAMA titled Strategies to Increase Cervical Cancer Screening with Mailed HPV Self-Sampling Kits. Pretty phenomenal concept. And joining us to discuss this is Dr. Amy Klaus. Dr. Klaus is the Associate Director and Head of Women's Health at the Family Medicine Residency Program at Jefferson Health, Abington. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you so much, Neil. Happy to be here.
This is, I just got to say, a fascinating article. Who would ever have thought we could look at self-sampling kits from home to take the place of pap smears? What is the background here that allowed them to even think to do this?
Well, if you think about it, a lot of organizations like the American Cancer Society, the American Society for Colposcopy, Cervical Pathology, and even the United States Preventive Service Task Force are all recommending primary HPV testing as one of the options for cervical cancer screening. So we think of that first, and then so we can use HPV testing alone. And then you think about that we now are using self-swabs for vaginitis. Why can't we use that also for HPV screening, self-swab options as well? And the truth is that self-swabbing for HPV has just in studies has about the same sensitivity and specificity as clinician collected swabs. So it makes sense to test out the theory if we could be doing those at home for patients.
Fantastic. Can you tell us briefly about the methodology for this study?
The researchers here, they looked at around 30,000 women aged 30 to 64. They were all members of a healthcare delivery system out in Washington that were identified through the electronic medical record. And they divided them into three different groups: those who were due or overdue for cervical cancer screening, and then those who had an unknown screening status, and then randomized them to one of four different options: either usual care, reminding them to get their pap smears, or educating them, sending them reminders through the electronic medical record, or sending them those reminders and mailing them in the mail a kit for that self-swab. They would, the kit and the directions on how to perform that, that they would mail back. Or the other option was to send them a option to opt into, an option to request that kit. So those were the four possibilities.
That sounds very well organized. And I'm guessing I know how this is going to turn out, but
yes,
would you
absolutely
tell us?
Yeah, absolutely. You know what's going to happen here. That so among those that were due for the cervical cancer screening, the completion rate was about 14% higher when mailed a kit compared to the education alone group, and only about 3.5% higher in those who had to opt into being mailed a kit. So being mailed the kit meant that patients actually mailed it back, went ahead and performed that instead of pressing the button to say, mail me a kit. And then in those that were overdue for their cervical cancer screening, the screening completion rate was almost 17% higher in those that were mailed the kit compared to the education group alone. So again, much higher overall. Mailing people the kit means that they will complete that HPV screening and mail it back.
And it really makes so much sense, right, when we think about it, because we all do better when we don't have to complete multiple steps of a task. What do you think are going to be the clinical implications of this study?
Well, if you think about it, there are a lot of patients who may be reluctant to come in and get a pelvic exam for a lot of different reasons. They don't like coming to the office. They don't like the speculum exam. Patients may have a history of trauma or sexual abuse that the pelvic exam is complicated for them for lots of different reasons. Those patients would be great people to provide a self-swab sent to their home that they can send back for. So I think great in those situations for patients overall.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think for all of us, you know, making the appointment, and everyone I talk to, it talks about how hard it is to make an appointment these days, right? You're on hold, you can't get an appointment for months. And then by the time that appointment comes around, you're like, it isn't a convenient day. So this just makes so much sense, particularly in an era where on the medical system side, there's sometimes some financial incentives for completing screening at a high rate among our population. And wow, to think of something that combines both good patient care, excellent outcomes, as well as good finances for the system, what a win-win.
I agree. A win-win. You know, and lots of other countries are already really utilizing both primary HPV screening as something that is done in those countries a lot. Huh. And then a lot of other countries are using that self-sampling. We just aren't doing it so much here in the United States just yet.
The times, they are changing. Dr. Amy Klaus, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Neil.
Next,
an article that was published in the BMJ titled Association Between Changes in Carbohydrate Intake and Long-Term Weight Changes, a Prospective Cohort Study. And let me say, this is an incredibly important article. And joining us to discuss this article is one of the authors, Dr. Walter Willett. Dr. Willett is a professor of epidemiology and nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Welcome, Walter.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Walter, can you give us a little background on why you all undertook the study?
Oh, sure. I think it goes without saying that weight gain is a huge issue in America, and actually most of the world for that matter, when we're in the middle of an unrelenting epidemic where just year after year, the prevalence of obesity is increasing. There's been, of course, for decades, interest in how diet affects weight gain or weight loss. But really, the biggest problem is, in fact, the weight gain, because Americans, on average, are increasing their weight about a pound per year, which doesn't sound very much. But if you're starting off at age 20, and of course, people are starting off even before that on their weight trajectory. Now, by the time they're 50, that's 30 or so extra pounds. And that has huge implications for health and well-being in general. And there's been a lot of interest in carbohydrate intake and weight change. And of course, we have extremes of low-fat, high-fat diets being proposed. And there hasn't really, we realize, been a detailed look at the long-term relation between carbohydrate amount and quality and weight change. So that was the background for why we looked at this.
That's fantastic. It's so important because while we've heard so much about treating obesity, and I think we've become very familiar with obesity as a chronic disease, we haven't spent as much time as it warrants on how to prevent weight gain. And this is so important. Can you talk to us about the methodology for this article?
Yes. For looking at this question, we used data from our three large cohort studies, the Nurses' Health Study, Nurses' Health Study 2, and Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. For this particular analysis, we had about 134,000 people in the analyses. And from actually starting in 1980, we've been collecting dietary data every 4 years in these cohorts. So we have tremendous longitudinal data on weight change over time. And every 4 years, we've also been updating dietary information. So we were, in this analysis, we were looking at change in diet and change in weight over 4 year intervals, and then putting those together over up to about 3 decades of follow up. So there's a huge amount of data here, and it allowed us to drill down in a lot of detail, the details of carbohydrate intake and foods that contribute to carbohydrate intake.
Fantastic. And now what we're all interested in is the results.
Yes. What we found was that carbohydrate overall intake was not very strongly related to weight change, but the quality of the carbohydrates was very important. There's a lot of data I could talk about, but just very briefly, we found that high glycemic index, high glycemic load, meaning carbohydrates raised blood sugar substantially, related to greater weight gain. On the other hand, whole grain, high fiber, and total fiber intake were related to less weight gain. And again, the more refined starches and more fine grains were related to more weight gain. We then drilled down to look at this in more detail. For example, at specific types of vegetables, fruits, other foods. And we found that starchy vegetables were actually related to more weight gain, with the potatoes being the biggest problem, but also peas and a few other starchy vegetables. And that's important because actually the current dietary guidelines in the United States say that we should be increasing starchy vegetable intake. That seemed a little bit surprising given our epidemics of obesity and diabetes. And this showed pretty clearly that increasing starchy vegetable intake was related to more weight gain. Of course, sugar-sweetened beverages are probably the worst offender because they are consumed in such large amounts by such a large part of the population. One interesting finding was that while there's been a lot of attention to sugar, we actually found per calorie or per 100 grams that refined starch actually had a bit greater adverse impact on weight change. And the amount, of course, of refined starch are even greater in our diet than the amount of sugar. So while sugar is certainly not good, only looking at that, keeping our focus only on sugar, leaves out as probably even a bigger villain in our diets.
Yeah, that's pretty phenomenal. So, I mean, this sounds consistent with something we've talked about with one of your colleagues, David Ludwig, the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis. Is this consistent with that?
This is consistent with the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis. There's conceivable, there's some other pathways as well. But in fact, just the whole issue of satiety is, I think, very much wound up with this too, because the high glycemic index carbohydrates are absorbed very quickly, whereas the high fiber whole grain types of carbohydrates do seem to convey greater satiety. And just even that simple aspect of diet quality is very important as well. But very consistent with the carbohydrate hypothesis also.
So you talked about the clinical implications with regard to large policy issues. Could you summarize for the clinicians listening to our podcast what you see as the clinical implications for advising individual patients in just a minute or two?
Well, sure. And actually, I might even go back further a step that it's one area we've been working on is physicians in general don't know what their patients are eating. And that's not a good starting point. Actually, about 20 years ago, we developed a simple screening questionnaire, and we published just a few months ago in the Journal of American Nutrition and Dietetics, JAND, this simple screening questionnaire, which we validated. It's about 12 items and takes about 2 minutes to administer, can be self-administered. So I think that one way or another, and this is a pretty efficient way, finding out what our patients are consuming is an important starting point. And there's no processing. It's just sort of stoplight kind of answers. And identifying people who are eating perhaps a lot of refined starches, minimal whole grains, that's a really important starting point for discussion with patients. Now that can lead to a room. It could be lead to group sessions, videos, written materials. There's all kind of branching of ways to transmit information and guidance about diet. But it's something that's, it's sad to say, sort of been missing in most clinical practices.
Well, this is so helpful. It's important information. And thanks for helping us to have direction to help our patients. Dr. Walter Willett, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for putting this on the table.
Our next article is going to be a discussion of recent guidelines published in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology on the care management of atopic dermatitis in adults using topical therapies, an important topic that we see a lot. And to discuss this article will be Dr. Katie McCormick, who is a third-year resident in the Family Medicine Residency Program at Jefferson Health Abington. Katie, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you know, this is important because it turns out that atopic dermatitis occurs in about 7 to 8% of adults in the United States, a little higher percent in children. And interestingly, of those who have atopic dermatitis, about 40% or greater is having moderate or severe symptoms. So that's a lot of people. That's 15 to 20 million people in the United States. But we didn't even have to go over that because we know from what we see in the office that we see a lot of this. And it'd be nice to either know some new suggestions or to confirm that what we're already doing is correct. Katie, can you talk to us a bit about what the guidelines recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely, this is such an important topic. I know, you know, we see this a lot in our office, especially kind of getting into the winter season. It'll certainly be important for us. So the article that we will be discussing tonight did, as you mentioned, kind of go over the different therapies that are available for managing atopic dermatitis, or as it's more commonly known, maybe as eczema. Talks about both non-prescription and prescription or pharmacologic modalities, but all kind of topical things that we might easily recommend to our patients. And kind of it does have a pretty broad scope here, you know, both going from non-prescription, non-pharmacologic things, different things like moisturizers, emollients, which we'll get into, and different bathing practices to, you know, different prescription creams, steroid things, and things like that. So we'll certainly get into all of that. And, you know, the evidence behind a lot of these does show pretty good recommendations, especially for the things like the steroids and the calcineurin inhibitors, which we'll talk about. But it just does really show kind of the scope of what we have to offer for our patients.
Yeah, and it is a lot. So let's start with non-prescription therapies. What do they recommend?
Definitely. So it talks about different kind of moisturizer things that aim to minimize the transdermal water loss. So different moisturizers that we can use just for the skin, very general and very, you know, easily accessible for our patients. And in a lot of the studies, some of the moisturizers had different products in them. But something that kind of stood out to me in the article were things like hyaluronic acid, which we know can kind of help as a barrier effort to prevent water loss. But things like that can be helpful to really limit the symptoms for someone that is experiencing eczema. And there is a strong recommendation behind the moisturizer as a modality for eczema or atopic dermatitis management.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. It strikes me that we often forget that part. And anecdotally, I've always thought that it helps, but I never realized what a strong evidence base there was there. Are there any other non-pharmacologic things that offer?
Sure. They did talk about different kind of applications of different bathing techniques. So bathing with different types of products. So this was actually kind of surprising to me. Bathing with bleach baths, they mentioned, or kind of different mineral baths. They didn't have quite as strong of evidence for this. And there really wasn't a lot of recommendation behind this, but interesting to know that's out there. But other things that they did recommend or that they did mention as well were things like a wet dressing and use that in combination with some of the pharmacologic agents that we'll talk about in a second. But essentially, you know, using the agent and then using wet dressing covered by a dry dressing to help really with that absorption. So that can be helpful. Conditionally was the recommendation. So maybe not for all of our patients, just, you know, with the, there's a little bit more behind the application of it. It takes a little bit more effort, but conditionally can be helpful for people with moderate to severe, the wet dressings and the product underneath the wet dressing that can be helpful for patients.
Yeah. And then, so we have our non-pharmacologic therapies. Mm-hmm. Probably the go-to is moisturizers. And then what do we have? What are the main things we have to offer for pharmacologic therapy?
Yeah, certainly. So kind of the two big ones that stand out, the two big categories are the topical calcineurin inhibitors and then the topical corticosteroids. You know, the topical corticosteroids, I don't know about you, Neil, but this is something that, you know, kind of comes to mind pretty quickly to mind. Maybe not as much the calcineurin inhibitors, but, you know, maybe that will be something that we see changing. We do have a lot of really good evidence behind the topical corticosteroids with the different strengths of the different topical corticosteroids. We have a lot of variability and I guess a lot of opportunity to treat for different periods of time. Obviously, with a stronger corticosteroid, we wouldn't want to treat for as long, but maybe middle of the road strength corticosteroid, we're able to use more safely for a longer period of time and actually prevent some relapses in some of the symptoms for atopic dermatitis. There are a variety of options with the topical corticosteroids, and there is strong evidence behind the topical corticosteroids, both the medium potency and the high potency for helping with symptoms, and then the medium potency for kind of managing and reducing the relapses. So again, that's something. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Katie, I was intrigued the way they did divide that up and was happy to see that really confirmed what we do often, which is you need to use a little stronger topical steroid to get things under control.
Bravo.
You don't want to stay at that level long term because it can cause skin atrophy and lightening of skin,
right.
But longer term to move to the medium or low potency steroids for maintenance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting as well. And you don't have to, you know, recommend use every single day for these medium potencies to prevent the flares. Even using them just twice a week can have a significant reduction in the relapse and the flare rate. So I thought that was really interesting and kind of helpful to know.
Pretty important. How about the topical calcineurin inhibitors, things like topical tacrolimus? Where do they fit in?
Yeah, sure. So again, as we mentioned, these might not be the first thing that come to our mind, but this might be something that we should be considering a little bit more because they do have pretty strong evidence for things like topical tacrolimus or pimecrolimus, which is another calcineurin inhibitor that have strong evidence behind good efficacy for management of the symptoms of atopic dermatitis and helping to maintain, similar to the steroids, the flares. So the tacrolimus comes in the 0.03 and 0.01 strengths, and that has strong evidence behind it. As well, the pimecrolimus, the 1% cream, had pretty good evidence behind it for mild to moderate atopic derm, just for, again, controlling those symptoms and, you know, preventing the flares.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I think we don't use this as often as the guidelines sort of indicated they might be used. And they did mention safety, and I'll quote here from the end of the section on this, was that while it's been talked about, and I'll quote here, cancer risk from TCIs is likely not clinically meaningful. So I think that is really reassuring for us and offers a very nice option for areas of the body where we might not want to be putting a topical steroid. Where might that be? If someone has dermatitis on their eyelids, sometimes on different areas of the face where the skin is very thin, it might be a particularly nice option there.
Right. And, you know, they are much safer and they don't carry the risks that we see with the topical corticosteroids. And I feel like they're more applicable to, you know, even some of our older patients, patients with thinner skin, that we might expect more side effects from the topical corticosteroids. So I definitely think that these are underutilized and, you know, I certainly will be trying to implement them more into my own practice.
Yeah, really great points. And did they mention any other newer agents that I don't think are really prime time medicines for us, but maybe worth us knowing about?
Yeah, so definitely things that are mentioned, maybe not as applicable to our general population use, but things like topical PDE4 inhibitors and topical JAK inhibitors, you know, they do show some evidence, strong evidence, in fact, especially for the topical PDE4. However, it's difficult. They might be a little bit more harder to afford for patients. They might not be as accessible for our patients or as widespread as some of the other treatments that we talked about.
Katie, this was such a helpful overview for many of us, confirming what we are doing, for many of us adding a little something, reminders about the real benefits of moisturizers, consistent moisturizer use, the use of topical steroids, higher potency initially, then going down to medium or low potency for maintenance, and the opportunity to use topical calcineurin inhibitors. Dr. Katie McCormick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Neil. This is great.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. From all of us at NACE.